Imagine you're in a heated argument, right? Emotions are running super high. Things escalate.
Oh, yeah.
Could words ever justify like a lethal reaction?
Whoa.
That's the intense scenario that we're diving into today.
Intense is right.
And we're using a real case
Oh, okay.
to explore it.
Okay.
Girard v. State,
Okay.
a 1991 Maryland case that continues to shape legal arguments even today.
Wow, 1991, that's a while
It
ago.
involves a young military couple, Stephen and George Girard, whose two-month marriage
2 month marriage.
ended in tragedy.
Oh.
Stephen stabbed Joyce 19 times during a fight.
Oh my gosh.
And the court had to decide, was this a clear case of murder? Or were there mitigating circumstances that could change the legal interpretation?
Right, and the core legal question here hinges on the difference between murder and manslaughter.
Okay.
Murder requires what's called malice aforethought, essentially premeditated intent to kill. Manslaughter, however, can sometimes be argued as a crime of passion,
Okay.
meaning the act was committed in the heat of the moment, triggered by a powerful provocation.
So the big question in Girard v. State was whether Stephen's actions were driven by malice
Right.
or by something else entirely. And that brings us to the legal concept of adequate provocation. Can you break that down for us?
Of course. The rule of provocation has four parts. First, was there adequate provocation?
Okay.
Second, did the defendant act in the heat of passion?
Gotcha.
Third, was there a cooling off period between the provocation and the act?
Okay.
And finally, is there a causal connection between the provocation and the killing?
Right.
What makes the Girard case so fascinating is that it hinges on that very first element, adequate provocation. Was there truly enough to justify Stephen's actions?
So let's get into the specifics of what happened that night. What led up to that tragic confrontation between Stephen and Joyce?
Well, court documents paint a pretty intense picture.
Okay.
Both Stephen and Joyce were in the army.
The argument began when Stephen overheard Joyce on the phone talking about filing charges against him that could potentially lead to a court-martial.
Oh, wow.
For our listeners who might not be familiar with military law,
Okay, yeah.
a court-martial is essentially a military court proceeding for violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Yeah. Ah, okay, so the stakes were already pretty high. Being court-martialed could have serious consequences for Stephen's military career,
Yeah.
maybe even his freedom.
Absolutely. And the argument escalated from there. According to court documents, Joyce reportedly insulted Stephen repeatedly, and there was even some physical contact.
Oh, wow.
Joyce stepped on Stephen's back and pulled his hair.
Okay, so we're not just talking about harsh words. There was physical aggression involved as well. How did the court interpret that in terms of provocation?
That's where it gets complex.
Okay.
While there was physical contact, the court really honed in on the verbal abuse, trying to determine whether words alone could ever reach that threshold of adequate provocation under Maryland law.
And that's where Maryland's specific legal approach comes into play.
Right.
They have a very strict categorical interpretation of what constitutes adequate provocation, focusing on very specific actions like adultery or mutual combat.
So almost like a checklist of acceptable triggers,
Yeah.
rather than a deeper consideration of individual emotions.
Yeah.
That seems like it could be pretty rigid.
Huh.
What if someone is particularly sensitive to a certain type of verbal emotion? Does the law account for that?
That's a really important question.
Yeah.
And it gets at the heart of a long-standing debate in legal circles. How do we balance an objective standard of law with the subjective realities of human experience?
Yeah.
In Girard, the court basically said that the legal system can't get bogged down in parsing individual sensitivities.
Okay.
They opted for the reasonable person standard,
Right.
which asks, would a reasonable person under similar circumstances be provoked to the point of committing such a violent act?
Okay, so the court is trying to establish a sort of baseline, a shared understanding of what constitutes reasonable behavior, even though we all know that people react to situations in different ways.
Precisely. And that's one of the things that continues to make this case so thought-provoking.
It definitely is. But before we get into the court's reasoning and the larger implications of their decision, there's one more detail I want to touch on. We mentioned that Joyce stepped on Stephen's back and pulled his hair. Did the court address that at all? And if so, why wasn't that considered sufficient provocation?
They did, but the court determined that those actions didn't meet the level of serious bodily harm that would justify such an extreme reaction.
Hmm.
They viewed it more as a minor physical altercation, not a threat to Stephen's life or safety.
That's interesting. I mean, doesn't context matter here?
Mm-hmm.
They were both soldiers, presumably trained in combat.
Right.
Wouldn't a reasonable person, especially one with military experience, potentially perceive a physical confrontation differently than someone without that background?
That's a great point. The court doesn't explicitly address that specific aspect of their military training in its written opinion.
Okay.
But remember, they were operating within Maryland's existing legal framework, which, as we discussed, takes a pretty strict view of provocation.
So they were working within those existing constraints. Okay. But they also had to consider the broader implications of their decision.
Right.
If they accepted verbal abuse as sufficient provocation in this case, what kind of message would that send?
Exactly. The court was very aware of the potential societal impact of its ruling.
Yeah.
In fact, they explicitly stated a concern that broadening the definition of adequate provocation to include words alone could lower the bar in domestic violence cases, potentially putting victims at greater risk.
So you're saying they were worried that abusers could use the "words made me do it" defense to justify violent acts?
Mm-hmm.
That's a chilling thought, and I can see why the court was treading carefully.
Absolutely. They were trying to strike a balance between recognizing the power of words to hurt and provoke, while also upholding a standard of accountability for violent actions.
Okay, so the court was sticking to precedent, considering the potential societal consequences.
Yeah.
What else did they emphasize in their decision?
Their third point really speaks to their commitment to that objective standard we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The court explicitly rejected psychological testimony about Stephen's emotional state, choosing to focus solely on the actions and events of that night.
Wait, really? So even if Stephen could have demonstrated a history of trauma or a specific vulnerability to certain types of verbal abuse, the court wasn't interested.
It does raise some questions, doesn't it? But remember, the court was operating within a legal framework that prioritizes an objective standard.
Right.
They were trying to determine what a reasonable person would do in a similar situation, not necessarily delve into the complexities of Stephen's individual psyche.
Okay, I get that.
Man.
They were trying to be consistent and fair. But there's another detail that I find really interesting.
Okay.
There was a significant size difference between Stephen and Joyce.
Right.
He was 6'2", she was 5'1".
What?
Did the court factor that into their analysis at all?
They did. In fact, they used the size difference to further support their argument that Stephen couldn't reasonably claim to be in fear of imminent bodily harm from Joyce.
So in their eyes, Stephen being much larger had the upper hand physically, which further weakened his provocation defense.
Yeah.
But wouldn't that also depend on the nature of the physical contact?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a smaller person could still inflict serious harm depending on the circumstances.
That's true, but the court focused more on the overall power dynamic, concluding that Stephen's size advantage made it less likely that he genuinely feared for his safety.
So we've got this complex interplay of legal principles, societal values, and the specific details of this case.
Yeah.
But before we wrap up, I'm curious. If the court wasn't swayed by the psychological testimony, what about other mitigating factors?
Okay.
Steve attempted suicide after the stabbing. Did they interpret that as genuine remorse, or was it dismissed as just another sign of instability?
That's a really interesting question, and it speaks to the limitations of court documents in capturing the full human story.
Yeah.
The court didn't explicitly address the suicide attempt in its decision. Their focus remained on the events leading up to the stabbing and whether those events met the legal standard for provocation.
It makes you wonder what goes on behind the scenes, right?
Yeah.
Like, how much weight do judges give to factors like remorse or mental state, even if they're not explicitly mentioned in the legal reasoning?
It definitely raises some questions about the line between the letter of the law and the broader considerations of justice and compassion.
So the court ultimately concluded that Stephen's actions were not justified under the legal definition of adequate provocation and upheld his second-degree murder conviction.
Exactly. They found that while words can certainly inflict pain under Maryland law, they don't reach the level of provocation that would mitigate a murder charge down to manslaughter.
But this case raises some bigger questions, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it goes beyond this one couple and this one tragic event. It gets at the very heart of how we as a society define the limits of acceptable speech, the power of words to harm, and the line between justified anger and criminal culpability.
You hit the nail on the head. Girard v. State isn't just about a legal outcome. It's a case study in the complexities of human emotion, the challenges of interpreting the law, and the enduring debate about where to draw the line between free speech and accountability for the consequences of our words.
It's a case that really stays with you, and it raises so many questions about where we draw the line.
Yeah.
I mean, are we saying that words can never be considered harmful enough to warrant legal consequences?
Not at all. The law does recognize certain types of speech as inherently dangerous.
Okay.
For example, direct threats of violence or inciting a riot.
Right.
These are considered exceptions because they pose a clear and present danger to public safety.
So those are situations where words are essentially considered actions.
Yay.
Because they have the potential to lead to immediate and serious harm. But in Girard, the court seemed to be saying that verbal abuse, even if it's incredibly hurtful or emotionally damaging, doesn't reach that same level of imminent threat.
That's right. And the court's concern, as we discussed earlier, was that broadening the definition of adequate provocation to include any type of verbal abuse could have unintended consequences, potentially undermining efforts to hold abusers accountable for domestic violence.
So it's a delicate balance,
right?
It is. Protecting freedom of speech while also recognizing that words can have real tangible consequences, especially in emotionally charged situations.
Absolutely. And this case highlights the ongoing tension between those two principles. It's a conversation that continues to evolve as our society grapples with new forms of communication and new understandings of the power of language.
So if our listeners were to take away one key insight from our deep dive into Girard v. C. State, what would it be?
I think the most important takeaway is that legal precedent, while rooted in history and tradition, is not static.
Okay.
It's constantly being shaped and reshaped by new cases, new interpretations, and evolving societal values.
That's a great point. So Girard provides a valuable snapshot of how the courts were thinking about provocation back in 1991. But it also serves as a reminder that the law is a living, breathing entity, and its interpretation can change over time.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important for all of us, not just lawyers and legal scholars, to engage in these conversations about the law, its limits, and its impact on our lives.
Well said. This has been such a fascinating exploration of a complex and thought-provoking case. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It was my pleasure. Until next time.